Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
This used to be my specialty. You know, I was good in the living room. They send me in there, and I do it alone. And now I just... Tonight, our little project, our company, had a very big night. A very, very big night. But it wasn't complete. It wasn't nearly close to being in the same vicinity as complete. Because I couldn't share it with you. I couldn't hear your voice. Or laugh about it with you. I miss my wife. I love you. You complete.
Well, that line became famous, didn't it? You complete me. I think it's famous because it's true. I'm going to show you that in a few minutes. We're studying a series together called Rethink, and we're talking for a few weeks on marriage, rethink marriage. Then we're going to look at rethinking parenting and rethinking work. And I'll bet you know some marriages that have had difficulties. Every marriage has. And I'll bet you know some that have been in divorce. Maybe you are a consequence of that, of that legal separation. And so we're all exposed to the difficulty in marriage, and we're trying to rethink it. And the reason we're naming it that is because I think that when I see people with difficulties in marriage and when we're having difficulties at home, it's not necessarily because we're not doing things right. That's a simple answer. We're probably not doing things right. But more importantly, we're not understanding the purpose of marriage. I think so many people end up in divorce court because they never knew what they were getting into in the first place. They didn't know what the purpose of marriage was. And so in 2007, 2009, we did a series, a few weeks each of those years on marriage. And there were a lot of how-tos, and we're going to look at how-tos and some practical things as well. But this time when we go through this material, we're going to look at some deeper things. We're going to answer questions about why instead of just how. Because those why questions are extremely important, especially when in the midst of suffering. I was watching one of the games lately, and I thought how difficult it must be to be one of the frontline coaches, you know, the big guys, the Goliaths of football, these men that are just absolutely enormous. But I've always been, if nothing else, entertained by some of their exercises, mostly the sled drill. And it's just a giant sled made out of very heavy iron. And the coach gets to ride it. He boards the sled and has a whistle. That's all he has. And he just tells the guys to hit the sled and push him across the field. When I blow the whistle, then you push. And they hit this thing at full speed ahead, and they push it across the field. And they turn around, they push it back and forth. And I wonder if ever maybe a new coach started doing this without explaining why. Because I wouldn't do it. Not that any Cassidy has ever pushed a sled. It would take six of us to move a mousetrap or something. Can you imagine a couple of linemen looking up as big as they are just saying, why? Why would we want to do that? I mean, immediately a coach would have to cut to some sort of film and saying, look, see this offensive line? Okay, they have four downs to go 3 yards and score a touchdown. And look what happens every time. The defensive line pushes them further and further back. The reason we're pushing this sled is so that next time when we're on that offensive line and we have four downs to go 3 yards, we're going to push them into the next zip code. That's why. Now let's go back out to the sled and do it. Oh, now that I know why, maybe I'll do this with more excitement. So we're going to look at that. We're going to look at the whys for the next few weeks or so, and we're going to look at just the power of knowing what God was up to in the very first place. Now, in our verses that we'll be looking at is particularly today, is in Ephesians chapter 5. If you'll turn there, I'm going to bounce all over chapter 5. I'm going to review from last week briefly, but Ephesians chapter 5 tells us why God brought up marriage. It refers to some primary verses in the book of Genesis. I'll start at verse 18 while you're turning there. Just to remind you, he says, don't be drunk with wine. It leads to debauchery, but instead be filled with the Spirit. So marriage is assumed to be people filled with the Spirit. Okay, and we're rethinking marriage. So verse 21 says, submit to one another in reverence or in fear of Christ. Verse 25, I'll go through a few verses and then we'll skip to 31. Verse 25 says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, and he gave himself up for her, and making her holy, cleansing her by washing with the water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any blemish, but holy and blameless. Now to 31. It's for this reason that a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And this is a profound mystery. Now I'm talking about the church and Christ. So, I mean, you can see there, it's making a reference. There's a lot there. We're gonna kind of unpack that today. But if you look there, you can see there's a reference to the original marriage ceremony. If you look in Genesis, God invented marriage. The crescendo of the creation story in Genesis is the making of man and wife, and then it peaks at the marriage ceremony where God brings Adam, his wife, Eve. In the last book of the Bible, Revelation, that peaks with this climactic wedding ceremony between the church and his bride, or the church, the bride, and Jesus Christ. So marriage is about, it's God. God invented it. God has the manual for it. And if we understand not just the how-tos, but the whys, the purpose of marriage, it will help us in our married life. If you buy something that's complicated, you're going to read the owner's manual. I'm appealing to you tonight or today just to read that owner's manual. If you buy a toaster, you don't read the owner's manual. Hopefully you don't. I don't know. You should plug it in, okay? But if you buy something complicated, sophisticated, difficult to comprehend that breaks easily, you're going to want to read how to do that. This is a profound mystery, marriage. You know, we need to read about the way God said it. It's supposed to be. So what I'm asking today, what I'm appealing to you is to start over. Some of you have been going to church way too long. You know the verses, and now it's just, now I'm boring you already. You know, it's like the same old thing. But listen, in the Bible, the definition of knowing is not repeating. It's the ability to do. Okay, in the Bible, it's not whether or not you've memorized something that counts. It's whether or not you're able to do that thing that counts. So if you're not doing it well, it's probably because you don't really know it by definition. Okay, and then those of you that are new to this whole idea of marriage, you didn't grow up in a church or didn't study the Bible much, you're going to look at this with new eyes, and actually you almost have an advantage over some of us that have been reading these passages for entirely too long. So here's I would love for you to start with a blank sheet of paper. And what I mean by that not is just not prejudice from your other Bible teaching or studies that you've been involved in, but also in your background. If you come, if you're home of origin, right? If you grew up in a family with unusual stability and great intimacy, I'd say, first of all, you weren't there when you were very young. You know, by the time you were cognizant of what was going on, things had been worked out. Because I hear people from that background say, my parents never fought. It's like, no, they never fought in front of you, or they were through with kind of the ugly stuff by the time you were observant. But what happens to that group of people that come from this unusually stable background is in their marriage, especially those first 5 years, is when they have arguments, they go, oh, no, this is not supposed to happen. We should be getting along happily. My mom and dad, they made out in the kitchen. And what? And so they, especially these days, people, they jump right to the end. Woe is us. It's over. Now, there's another group on the other extreme that they come from a very difficult background. There was closed or just coldness in the relationship, maybe even no relationship at all. Or they were arguing all the time, and then they get married. And the first sign of fault or crack in a young marriage, again, they jump right to the end of the story and say, oh, I know where this is going. I saw this in my parents. Woe is us. We're doomed. I'm asking, would you please consider starting all over again with a blank sheet of paper? Looking at some of these passages for your sake, for the sake of your friends, for the sake of your future, if you're young and unmarried, just let's look at this, okay? That's my appeal. So the first reason God brings about marriage is found in Genesis, and it is for this. It's kind of long, but we'll dissect it. A special romantic Christian companion. The purpose of marriage originally was for a special romantic Christian companion. Let's look at the first few words that need to be described. A special companion. Really, the word is friendship. Honestly, I just wanted to make sure that it was a little deeper than that because of how that word's been diluted. If you read in Genesis chapter 1, in the story of creation, when God's making all things, seven times he says, it is good. And those seven times are to accentuate not just the creation of God, but also to contrast kind of the lead balloon that hits the ground when he says, it is not good. And that expression, it is not good, happens when Adam realizes that he is all alone. That God has made human beings with exceptional capacity for relationships. And here's the point in Genesis 1 that you need to hear, that even in the Garden of Eden, with an undefiled, perfect relationship in paradise with God, it is not good. I'll say it another way. God is not enough. There. God is not enough in paradise with intimacy with him. It was not good for man to be alone. And this is before the fall that causes us to be selfish and towards isolation. And God saw that and made Adam see that, and so he did something about it. Now I want to just kind of say in a kind of an application over here that a lot of people try to pursue paradise without relationships even to this day, and they pursue wealth and safety and comfort and pleasure, and yet there's emptiness, and the reason is because it is not good that man would be alone. We couldn't do it in the Garden of Eden. We can't do it now, especially that we're broken. And that's why in Proverbs especially, it acknowledges and puts on a pedestal a happy man, a poor man that's happy with a loving family over a rich man that's miserable. Because we are primarily in the image of God, and in that image, we are relational. We are communal. We are to be intimate and transparent and loving towards one another. And so what does God do about this fact that it is not good for man to be alone? He brings him what's called an Ezer in Hebrew. It is a very special companion. It's a very close friend. It's a very special friend and has attributes that only Eve could have. He brings Eve to Adam, and when they meet, basically what's being said there, Adam says, at last. It's flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone. She's literally been made from him, but he does not make a copy of Adam. He makes a complement of Adam. He has made Eve so that she complements his soul, she complements his spirit, right? And she complements his body. They are working hand in glove together. It is, right? It's not the same thing. It's something that works better with those things that were lacking, even in a complete Adam. Those things that were lacking are now filled with Eve. And so there is, that's the point of the Jerry Maguire clip there, is it's a true statement that Eve is introduced to Adam, and Adam can say, oh, you complete me. Now, the theme of that movie, I don't want to digress too much, but the theme of that movie is he's stolen that line from someone. The movie starts with those two getting on an elevator, and someone else joins them in the elevator, and the man says to the woman, or vice versa, whichever, it says, you complete me. And Tom Cruise is in that scene going, Jerry Maguire's in that scene going, really? Whatever. It's like, stop right there. Really? Whatever? So the rest of the story is about him evolving. He's going to learn what intimacy is because he's just a selfish person that uses other human beings. And he has to learn or die trying what it means to love and to be loved, what it means to need and to have those needs met, what it means to live a life regardless of financial success or failure, to have someone to complete them. and to complete someone else. He's not even, he's barely human at the beginning of this journey. And that's where it makes its peak right there, is he gets it. Now he understands the point of being human is to be completed this way. So the character of companionship, or these attributes of friendship that I want to acknowledge today, a couple, there's a lot, and you can find them in Proverbs, especially in the definitions of friendships, but this special companionship, this special friendship, the two I want to bring to mind are loyalty, right, and safety. Loyalty is the mate that is ours by God, and the vows that we take that says, I will love you whether things are going well or they're not so much, whether you're successful or whether you're a failure, where when you're healthy and when you're not. And I'm going to be there for always. And so because, you know, that kind of follows, right? Because of that loyalty and that commitment, I will always be there to encourage you or strengthen you or to correct you. That leads to safety. We're supposed to be able to completely open our souls to one person on the planet, and that is the person that has sworn to God that they would never leave us. And because of the vows they've made and we've made to them, they can be that. And so we open ourselves up. We've made this a safe place to say whatever is true in our lives, no matter how horrendous it might be. And what that does is it lets you say things and be you. Lets you be you. I came across a quote from 1877, a book on friendship and marriage, and she writes this. It is the inexpressible comfort we have, this safety of friendship, this inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh our thoughts or nor measure our words, but pouring them all out just as they are, chaff and grain together, certain that a faithful hand will take them and sift them and keep what is worth keeping, and then with grace blow the worthless away. That's this special friend. This person that is able to be in the audience while you're expressing yourself. And listen, the purpose of this great friendship is, as iron sharpens iron, one man sharpens another, right? Faithful are the wounds of a friend. This special friend has the ability and kind of the job description to be the one who gives the deepest wounds to us because of their commitment. Now, the second thing, besides, right, this very special friend, now we have a special Christian companion. And the reason I've added that is well, because of the Bible. Throughout the Old Testament says you have to marry a follower of Jehovah, right, a person who's following the laws of Moses and all the other rituals. But in the New Testament, it fulfills, right, the laws of the Old Testament, and it's the culmination of the promises of God. Then you have to have this person in your marriage, this person you're married to, have this common denominator, because it's supposed to be the central focus of your life. I mean, by definition, God and his pursuits for your soul, that is supposed to be the central focus of your life. And it's the theme of Ephesians. We've gone through this all throughout the fall. But look, the differences you have are incidental when you compare them to the centrality of Jesus. So your ethnic background, your socioeconomic background, right? Your race, your education, you know, your, I don't know, history and your culture, all that, right? What does the Bible say about that in Ephesians? Well, God's put all that under one head. And while all those things are fun and entertaining and can spice up life, right? It's not the core of who you are. And so what would be antagonistic and reasons for fighting for other people that don't have a bigger purpose with those who follow Christ and is the blueprint that you're both reading from, blueprint, you're building your life based on this, right, the teachings of Christ. Well, these other things are just accents to that singular focus. So that's why it's so important. It's just two of you journeying together. When Melinda and I were dating and when we got married early on, we realized we didn't have a whole lot in common. I mean, we didn't like the same movies. We didn't like the same kind of food, decorations, sometimes clothing. Didn't like the same hobbies. Didn't like the same music. And over the years, you know, it's changed vacations. We didn't, you know, she liked going to the mountains. I like going to the beach. And we've changed over the years. There's some musicals that I like. mostly the ones that have good fighting scenes, like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. There's some realistic fights in that, and those are manly men for the most part. While we had all these things that really weren't overlapping, the thing that attracted us to each other, the reason we were attracted to each other was the thing that was primary. We wanted to both live lives, right, that where God was going to use us somehow, and we would live a life so that only God could explain what happened. And we wanted to do that with as many people as possible. We wanted to bring and help bring people along for the ride, right? To be used by God and to live a life that could only be explained if God was regularly intervening in our lives. Well, we both saw that in each other, and we just like, well, we should do this together. And that's how we started our journey together, because we saw the centrality of being surrendered to Christ as primary, and the other things were petty. So again, I'm describing this purpose for Eve being brought to Adam. It is this special, now romantic, Christian companion. Yeah, now we're talking. That's why we're here, to talk about that. And the romantic part is this sexual intimacy is bringing a super, it's pleasurable physically, sure, no doubt, but it's bringing in the psychological and spiritual dimensions of things that make it a profound mystery. Because, listen, your mate is supposed to be the one who says the hardest and most hurtful thing to you, okay? Now, it's not in the delivery, okay? I'm sure it takes years, honestly, to figure out how to do that effectively. But it's the content of the truth and the fact that it's true that it's going to hurt you deepest. And so while this isn't like other relationships that would cause you to kind of be pushed away, because of this romantic addition being brought into Adam's life and you with your mate, then the injuries that take place because truth is being told are able to be healed through the power of sexual intimacy. And sometimes they can only be healed that way. So when you have right loyalty and safety, and you're being talked through some of your difficulties in such deep and hurting ways, then you have this balm of a transcendent connection that can only be explained and provided by God. And that is why. That's why God brought Eve to Adam. Once the vows are made, then we can be safe and exposed and vulnerable to each other, and we can enjoy that. Now listen to what your vows sound like. Listen to what your vows sound like when you keep in the context of the purpose of marriage is to provide, right, a special romantic Christian companion, a Christian friend. You know, right? To be my wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, right? For better, for worse, absolutely. That's loyalty. For richer or for poorer, you bet. In sickness and in health, I will love and cherish you until death do us part. Can you see how those vows before God are the essential things that are necessary so that you can enjoy what God provides? And that is, right, this very special romantic Christian companion for life. So that's the purpose. That's the purpose of marriage before there's a Genesis chapter 3 and the fall of man. And all is well until after that. Then man falls, and then the nature of man is demented and torn and bent, like a car that's had its frame bent. And now it is bent away from God. The nature of man is bent away from God and into isolation. And so whenever we have difficulties with relationships, what do we want to do? We want to go off on our own, start our own little village on an island somewhere where we are always right. And many expressions of arguments are that very thing. Because the second purpose of marriage now is to refine us. It is to refine us. Because we are wholeheartedly self-centered. And you know that when the honeymoon's over. And the honeymoon's usually over on the honeymoon. When you start realizing the radical self-centeredness of your mate, and you think that their radical self-centeredness is more than your somewhat selfish behavior. Right? And what happens is, you know, and there's lists in the Bible of being, right, selfish and impatient and holding on to grudges. There's the list is easy for self-centeredness, right? But this is a spiral of death because you start off by being impatient and disruptive to the relationship, and they respond usually in kind and they towards isolation. And then you respond in isolation, and you're growing farther and farther apart because self-centeredness is what's driving you apart. And it just continues to get worse and worse. And again, the definition by almost, it's simple, but one of the descriptions of self-centeredness is blindness to your selfishness. And so you don't even understand what you're giving. All you hear is what you're receiving. And the more wounded you are in your background, the more deaf you are to your own selfishness. And that's one of the consequences of being wounded is you grab more towards self-centeredness and you can't hear what you're doing to other people. And so, I mean, you can see it's an obvious crazy maker. It's an obvious way for this thing never to work. And so God, in his mercy, adds right after be filled with the Spirit. This is going to take supernatural power to chapter 5, verse 21. I'll put it up on the screen here. Submit to one another out of reverence to Christ. Submit to one another out of reverence to Christ. Instead of a spiral of death, you know, Paul is proposing, hey, listen, if you follow God's way on marriage, how about a spiral of life where you're to submit to one another in the fear or reverence of Christ? What reverence being fear. It's like, okay, I get this. You need to act like what Jesus acts like. And he was reverent, or he was rather submissive. So watch how this works sometimes in marriage. Once people get this, it's almost enjoyable to watch. So instead of going farther and farther apart, being selfish, just I'm going to get what I want, you start off somewhere and you say, you know what? I want to submit to your needs. I want you to be happy. And so you move towards them, right? And this person responds, maybe they're a little competitive about it. That's not a bad thing. Oh, really? I want you to be happy. I'm going to submit to what you want. No. I'm going to submit to your needs. I want to make sure your needs get met. Okay, that's fine. We'll get your needs met, but your needs will be met first. And what happens is when two people are submitting, and if there's only one, it's still moving in the right direction. But when people realize that submission is the power of union, it's a game changer. It really is. And again, the power in this is that we're made in the image of God. And what is God's image like? It submits. It's like God to lower himself to us, not be concerned about his needs being met or whether we deserve it, but whether he serves us first. And that's how marriages work. The word submission, I know it's, boy, especially in America, right? I mean, it just cries us crazy. It goes against everything. It absolutely does go against everything. Selfish. But it's a military term. The context of Ephesians, they knew it. It's a military compound in many respects. And the church of Ephesus knew that if the military were to ever get anything done, you have to have submission. I mean, by definition, right? You go in, I don't know much about the military, but you guys, some of you men and women do. You walk in the room, you're a free man or a woman, right? Then you raise your right hand, you say a few words. It's a vow, just like marriage. And then what happens? Then somebody else tells you what you'll wear, when you'll sleep, what you'll eat, when you'll wake up. It won't be when you want, right? What you'll do with your day. When you'll vacation and where you'll vacation, when you'll be back, and what you'll call me from now on, right? I mean, you lose all of your ability to make independent decisions. When you walk before a pastor and you say your vows and you swear to God, you're doing the same thing. You're losing your ability to make individual decisions. Now it's a collective we. It's us. And I think God is funny in this. I think there's something to it. I mean, how many movies, stories, sitcoms, TV series, whatever we're being exposed to, how many of those are stories of a group of people entering a room full of ego, and they won't get anything done until they submit to the bigger cause and then submit to each other? You see, whether it's racism on a football team, right? How many times has that been made? That story been played? Or people in a workplace? Or again, the military, the Dirty Dozen is great. 12 guys that are selfish and mostly criminal. And they won't get anything done until they submit to each other and submit to the bigger cause. So, do you see? That's the way God works. If you submit to Him, then you'll submit to each other. If you act like Christ, and to die is to live. When Jesus said that, He meant it. He meant it in marriage. Years ago, I was a teaching assistant up at Gordon-Conwell. It's a graduate school, and I was evaluating guys' sermons and some of the guys and gals there. And there was this one person that was having a lot to deal with. And I accidentally misspoke, because he said, "Look, what do I need to do to get better at this?" And I said, "Boy, you just need to get married." He said, "What do you mean by that?" I said, "Well, look, I can't explain it. Do you have some really good friends that are married?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You need to ask your really good friends that are married, because until you get married, you're always right. And you won't let anyone tell you otherwise. You have got to say some vows to God that will have someone follow you into that bedroom and remind you how wrong you are. And no one else can do that, so you'll just need to do that." The spirit of selflessness isn't like you saying you're lower than other people, and it's not making your mate into like a savior figure. It is understanding who Christ is in your life and gaining your power from His Spirit, right? Be filled with the Spirit, and with that being able to be givers in your marriage and not takers. That's what it means. So we have this, right, this very special Christian romantic companion, and then we have this other purpose of marriage being refining. And here's this last one it's really taken to my mind in the last 5 years especially. It's to present to God, to present to God. Look at 5:25 through 27, and could you imagine it for just a moment? Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church, and He gave Himself for her, see, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing of the water through the word, and to present her to Himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any blemish, but holy and blameless. The idea here is that you are a special person that will be part of presenting your mate to God. Okay, and the idea is to be holy and blameless without spot or wrinkle, right? And I mean, this is the purpose of life, is to be conformed to the image of Christ. In Philippians, it says, he who began a work in you will carry it out till the day of completion, till the day of Christ. In church, it's a big word. It's called sanctification. It's being made saints. And I think Paul's asking us to envision what Christ is going to do to the church someday. He's going to present the church, His bride, right, without spot, without wrinkle, without blemish, and holy and blameless. And he's going to be up there as the groom. And he's going to be basically saying, I helped do this. And that's what we're to do with our mates. That's how we're supposed to select our mate. We're supposed to see that God is out to make us like Jesus, okay? Or Adam, if you would, Adam and Eve before the fall. And here's how people get attracted to each other. You're going along this journey, right, of becoming like Christ, and you see someone else and you see what God will do in their lives, right? You see a human soul, right? Not the body, right? We fall in love with souls and spirits first. And we see a soul and we go, oh, I think I know where God's taking this. I know what God might do in your life. I see where God's taking you. This is kind of, I would like to be the person that gets to present you. I want to be part of that. God's doing stuff in your life. I know where He's going with you. Can I be there with you? That is a spiritual proposal. You're looking at someone else, not for what you'll get, but what you'll be able to participate in and give. And you want to be able to be there and stand there during this presentation of this other human soul. Look at it this way. The marriage itself is practice, right? You're probably never younger. You're never more dressed up. The bride is wearing a dress that it is inexplicably more expensive than anything should be, and appropriately so. And the guy's wearing a tuxedo because that's as good as we can get. And again, right? We're all dressed up, and then we're presented to God as we make these vows. And the bride's dress, right? It's holy. It's white. It's blameless. There's no spot or wrinkles on this. And so the goal of our lives as married people are to do that with our mate. Kind of will be in the background a bit, right? But, you know, it's like, God, here's Melinda, you know? And here we spent years together. And I think he's supposed to look at me if I do this right. It's what I'm living for. Is he says, well done, my good and faithful servant. The way you sacrificed, you know, the way you submitted to her needs, the way you cheered her on when she was down, and the way you strengthened her when she was weak, and the way you corrected her when she was wrong so that she could hear it better. The way, look what you have done by presenting her to me. What a day that would be, right? That's what marriage is for. That's why we get to say vows that are eternal. Then we get to live a life so that we present our mate and they are radiant. They are radiant in a room full of Christ's presence. All of creation is his footstool, and we present our mate to him. We get to do that. This is a profound mystery. I can't explain a lot of it. But the sex and the romance and the laughter and all that's just the dressing. This is a purposeful thing, and it is work. If you are hearing me say that, hey, I thought marriage was to make me happy, and now you say it's hard work and suffering, then you're getting the message. You got it. But everything we want in life is requires us to work, doesn't it? Don't we want something that's hard to have? And marriage is part of that. Listen, for you nerds, let me put it this way. Marriage is God's way of sending his spirit dressed like a wizard to say to you, I'm going to take you places you don't want to go so that you can do things you don't want to do, so that you will have gone there and have done them. And you will someday tell stories about slaying a giant fire-breathing dragon. So get out of your comfortable little hobbit that is all self-centered and come with me and live the journey you were meant to live. Life following Christ is the journey. I mean, it is the great adventure. Following Christ is the great adventure. And marriage is the person you get to share a tent with along that adventure. Next week, I'm going to tell you about what can power a life's transformation. I really hope you come back. We're going to look at some great things. This week, let's just pray that our hearts would be open to starting all over again today. Lord Jesus, let us be open and acknowledge that we hold on to injuries and it keeps us from moving forward. And so whatever our backgrounds have been, whether it's, you know, maybe we're on our third marriage or maybe we're just in the middle of something, or we're just getting tired. God, I'd ask that you'd help us start over and see that there's a purpose in all of this, pushing this sled. And I'd ask that you would help us be encouraged to want to do, through the power of your Spirit, do the things that would give us such a great finale to life. this finale of all creation where we could present our mate to you and you would say, wow, well done. That is very nicely done. You did complete each other just like I thought. Lord, let us be those types of people and let us be encouragers of other people around us for that purpose. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.